This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Justin Yackel. He's a paleoecologist. He's a postdoctoral fellow at the Santa Fe Institute. He's an assistant professor at the University of California, Merced. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So you study ecosystems, climate change, food webs, endangered species, all these things that are important to us today. But you're looking at things that happened thousands of years ago, paleoecology. First of all, tell us about this field. Why do you study these things? What can they tell us about our own era?
Sure. Really, our understanding of past systems is, in my perspective, a key to understanding how our own world works, how future ecosystems might function. And that's primarily because when we look into the past, experiments have already been done. So we have to decipher what has occurred. And there are a lot of phenomena that have occurred in past ecosystems that are relevant to our understanding of modern ecosystems, like large perturbations to the climate, large changes to the community, big perturbations that...
Perturbations.
Yeah, perturbations, big changes, big...
Disturbances,
disruptions that we can't experiment with in modern systems. It wouldn't be ethical to do so if we could, but we just don't have the capacity to do it anyway.
Let's make a giant earthquake.
Yeah. We generally like to keep the things that we have around us. We don't like to disrupt them in large ways that are that could cause additional problems. So one way of understanding how disruptions can influence how a community of animals evolves or changes over time is to look at past systems that have undergone similar size perturbations.
So let's talk about ancient Egypt, which you've written about. What were the conditions of land and climate that gave rise to that flourishing of civilization and agriculture?
Yeah, it's kind of a funny situation when you look into ancient Egypt, because what you find is before about 5,500 years ago, Egypt was a fairly, you know, wet place. It was more similar to the modern Serengeti. It was a grassland woodland environment with a lot of flora and fauna that are no longer there, and it was a very productive ecosystem. Over time, due to natural changes to the climate, it changed. It dried out. There was a large aridification event that began about 5,000 years ago.
Meaning drying.
Drying. Yeah, exactly. And this was a gradual process that changed the structure of the vegetation there. It went from a savanna-like environment with a lot of woodlands and grasslands to more of what we think of it today, a desert-like environment where the only greenery is found along the Nile Valley and its tributaries, essentially. And it's during this time of drying that human civilization began to flourish. And it's a little antithetical to what you'd expect as a system becomes less productive, more desert-like, that you see this blossoming of culture. And there's a lot of hypotheses and opinions about why that came about, how that came about. Essentially, what we know is when Egypt was a wetter place, people were mobile pastoralists. They were moving sheep around, they were moving goats around, and they were living off of these animals. As it became drier, they began to settle. And they settled around the region where there was water, the Nile Valley, and they began to cultivate grain. And by staying in one spot, they really set the foundation for large cultural production, like
right.
The establishment of cities, the beginning of large political operations. You know, all of that is centered around staying in one place. And the reason they were probably having to stay in one place is because the system was drying out, except around the Nile Valley.
So how did ancient Egyptians affect the ecosystems upon which their civilization was built? I mean, we are becoming continually aware of our effect on land and water. Was there any similar effect on the species, on the ecosystems of that time?
We don't know how the Egyptian people themselves influenced their environment. We do know that their environment changed over time as their civilization grew. Whether this was a direct consequence of their civilization or way of life is really difficult to disentangle. What we do see, though, is at the end of the Pleistocene or the beginning of the Holocene is the time era that we live in now, this was about 11.5 thousand years ago, there were 37 species of mammals larger than 4 kilograms. So these are larger-bodied mammals like lions, leopards, wildebeest, hartebeest, African buffalo, giraffe, elephants. All of these animals we think of, you know, when we think of the Serengeti, were also in Egypt. So there was just incredible richness of mammalian species living in those regions. And today there's only 8 species. So there was this large drop in species richness over the Holocene as Egypt became drier and as human civilization flourished. We don't know which of those mechanisms had the larger influence. However, both of them probably did have some influence. There was a gradual drying out that occurs across the Holocene. There were also these periodic, they call them large aridification events. And that means just a really severe drought over a really short period of time. And these large-scale aridification events, there were about 3 of them. And they're all associated with changes in political regimes. For example, the Old Kingdom in Egypt going into the first Intermediate Kingdom. And the Intermediate Kingdom is a progression of multiple rulers that rule for a very short period of time. It's thought to be associated with political instability, famines, droughts, all of these large climatic effects that impacted people's lives are recorded in the Egyptian record. One of the nice things about studying Egypt is that they were incredible observers of the natural world, and they recorded their observations in artwork and writing and literature and all of these other ways of recording information that give us a really fine resolution understanding of what occurred over the history of human occupation in Egypt. So we know of these aridification events both by looking at deep sea cores where, you know, we can see shifts in pollen, frequencies of fire, just all of these indicators that show us that drought was very pronounced over these, you know, 3 periods of time. We also see the impacts of this on human societies. And when we reconstruct using the record of animal depictions and artwork and all of these other means of determining which animals were present on the landscape, we actually see fairly large shifts in the animal community composition during these aridification events, during these mass droughts.
What kind of shifts did you see? What kind of changes?
Well, one of the primary changes that we see is changes to the ratio of predators to prey. This is just a very simple way of examining the structure of the community. And when I say the ratio of predators to prey, I'm not talking about the absolute numbers, but just the number of species. So for example, during the first aridification event, there's an increase in the predator-prey ratio, which means that
more predators,
more prey are going extinct, right, relative to the predators, and that increases the ratio. And during the subsequent aridification events, we see additional shifts in the predator-prey ratio that are much larger than you'd expect just based on the times when there aren't dramatic climatic shifts.
So ever fewer prey animals, by which we mean things like deer and gazelles and herbivores.
Exactly.
And lots of predators with nothing to eat.
Exactly. Yeah, it suggests when there's large shifts to the predator-prey ratio, it suggests some kind of selective extinction mechanism. And we don't really know what that mechanism is, but we can examine the effects of these different extinction events that seem to occur alongside with these dramatic droughts.
I have to say, it is pretty cool that for you working as a paleoecologist, part of your data set is art and literature.
Well, so one of the problems in paleontology is that we often deal with resolution issues. So if we're looking at fossils in rock, one strata of rock that's right next to another strata of rock might be separated by tens of thousands of years, maybe even hundreds of thousands of years. And so we could assemble counts of fossils that we find in these different rock strata, but our understanding of how the community is changing in time has these huge gaps in it. That is just the consequence of geological activity, and we can't really control that. One of the benefits of looking at a place like Egypt is taking advantage of human observations and the fact that, you know, people are recording what they see in their artwork, and that their artwork is really precisely dated because people have been studying Egyptology for better part of 200 years. And so there's just really accurate reconstructions of when certain pieces of artwork were produced.
Yeah, the art historians did the work for you, essentially.
Absolutely, yeah. And so we took advantage of all of the work that the art historians have already done to assemble a larger picture of the community of animals that were present in and around the Nile Valley during that time.
So depictions in one century might show, I'm just making it up, but zebras, and like 200 years later, there's no zebras. So you can conclude that they've gone extinct?
Well,
they've moved away?
We infer that they've gone locally extinct. All of these animals that were present in Egypt are still alive today somewhere. So there weren't any saber-toothed tigers or anything like that. So all of these extinctions are just local extirpations. So these populations are no longer functioning. They might have moved away. They might have died in Egypt. They just no longer function within the community. And essentially by assembling which species were present when allows us to understand how the community changed through time. And then we can evaluate how the community functioned differently as the result of these local extinctions.
So how did, like, you've got local extinctions of certain animals, how did that affect the people living there? In other words, were they eating those animals, or how did it affect communities?
Well, most of these communities were probably living on cultivated plants. Certainly wild animals may have played a part in some of their diets. It's unlikely, in my mind, that they would have been subsisting entirely on these wild animals. Now, I guess I should make clear, we focused only on the wild animal part of the equation. Certainly there were many domesticates that were brought in. These are clearly distinguished in the artwork. There were even animals that were imported from other areas as tribute. And that's also distinguished in the artwork. They're often labeled as imported.
But these are animals that are domesticated and eaten?
Yes. So they had domesticated animals.
What?
Well, they had cows. I think they had pigs later on that were brought in from Asia. They had goats. So there certainly was livestock. And it's possible that these animals also interacted with the wild community also. Some of the best depictions of the wild animal community are actually on the tombs of pharaohs, because they would paint these elaborate hunting scenes on their tombs of the pharaoh hunting these animals during his life with the expectation that he'll have better hunting success in the afterlife with these images depicted on their tombs. And so these are all animals depicted in their wild environment alongside other animals. And so these are the types of artwork that we took advantage of, depictions of animals in their natural environment, in their ecological theater.
I have to ask you this just because I kept thinking about it when I was reading your work. Art is not only document, but it's imagination, it's interpretation. I mean, if some archaeologist were to find, let's say, all the television of the year 2015, they might think that we had dragons and unicorns.
Well, and there are mythical animals that are depicted in Egyptian artwork as well. There's griffins, there's these animals that are called serpipards, and they have a neck of a giraffe, but a head of a lion. And of course, we didn't include these mythical animals in our data set.
Right.
But they're certainly depicted, and there's also some hypotheses that these animals weren't completely made up out of thin air, that they were potentially reconstructions of fossil animals that they found, fossil potentially dinosaurs or early mammals. Griffins are thought to be serapod dinosaurs, or inspired by serapod dinosaurs.
So when you come to a study like this, what did you finally conclude? I mean, you put together all of this data from not only the scientific record, but art and literature and so on, and you see these mammals going, as you call it, locally extinct. You see the sort of rise and decline of civilization as lusher landscape turns into desert. What do you conclude? Where does this lead you as a scientist?
Yeah, so What we did in our study was not so much to examine the causes of these changes. The causes are multiple, and it's difficult to establish causality in the record. What we can do is determine the consequences of these changes. So one of the things that we analyzed as the community shrunk from 37 species of mammals to 8 today is examine how the food web functioned. And one way to examine that is to determine mathematically how stable it is. And that essentially means, given some system of interacting animals, if I perturb it, if I push it a little bit, if I disturb it, how does it react? Does it go into some other state and cause other extinctions down the road? Or does it respond to where it was? Or does it essentially, is it elastic or not? If it's elastic, it goes back to where it was. If it's sensitive to perturbations, it goes into some other state.
So what are some examples, like let's take ancient Egypt. What are some examples of resilient and maybe not so resilient species and interactions of that kind?
Well, for example, if I were to take a community of interacting animals where the interactions are primarily trophic interactions, or who eats whom.
Right.
And so it's a food web, essentially. If I disturbed one of those species, let's say I disturbed the abundances of lions. I went in and I took out half the population of lions. If that disturbance trickled through the food web and caused other extinctions, that would be an example of an unstable system. However, if the lion simply responded to the disturbance that I injected into it by rebounding, by increasing their reproductive rate and recovering without further disturbance, that would be an example of a stable system.
Now, are you talking about a stable system as a whole, meaning a system full of different species, or are you talking about a specific species like lions?
Well, we can look at both. We can look at the stability of the system as a whole, and we can look at the sensitivity of individual species within that system. And we did both in our analysis. We analyzed the community as a whole as the species went extinct from 37 to 8, and we found that
37
species
went
down
to 8 species.
Yeah, exactly.
We're talking about these big mammals.
These are all mammals larger than 4 kilograms.
Right.
So, yeah. So in other words, not counting the rodent communities and other animals that are less represented in Egyptian artwork, essentially. And we found that as the extinctions accumulated, the stability of the system declined. So the system became more and more sensitive to perturbation, to external disturbances, as species went extinct. And we could also analyze the sensitivities of individual species and how those changed over time. In other words, how sensitive were the surviving species to additional disturbances as the system changed, as it became less rich, as extinctions accumulated. And what we found was that species that were more sensitive at the beginning were more likely to go extinct. So these mathematical determinations of stability at the species level did seem to have some predictive power, such that those species that were predicted to be more sensitive to extinction were the ones that didn't last as long in the system. Those were the ones that were lost.
What constitutes sensitivity versus robustness? Like, how do you observe that?
These are all intertwined. They're all related to one another. And so you can't really disentangle the two. So the sensitivities of all the species in the system are interwoven into the idea of stability of the system as a whole. And the stability of the system as a whole has an influence on the sensitivity of individual species. So they're really looking at the problem from different perspectives rather than different problems.
One thing that seems to be perhaps a universal, I don't know, you can tell us, is that the fewer species you have, the more sensitive and vulnerable the system is. Is that true?
That's what we found in Egypt. And essentially why that happens is that Egypt lost a lot of smaller-bodied herbivores, smaller to medium-sized herbivores.
What are some examples of those?
Like gazelles.
Uh-huh.
There are multiple species of gazelles that were lost. And those animals play a really important role in maintaining the stability of the system as a whole. Essentially, there's redundancy. So just like a really complicated machine, if it's redundant and you lose one of those redundant parts, the machine won't fail because it's redundant. It has backups.
Yeah.
Similarly, the ecosystem in Egypt, 6,000 years ago, there were multiple species of gazelle. If one species of gazelle went extinct, it didn't have a large impact because there's many other similarly sized species that the predators in that system can switch to. Today, there's only a few species of gazelle. There's only a few species of smaller to mid-sized herbivore within that weight range that a lot of consumers depend on, a lot of predators depend on. So when one of those species is lost, the predators aren't able to switch. So the system is much more sensitive to additional extinctions today than it was 6,000 years ago. 6,000 years ago, when there was a lot of redundancy, you could basically take any piece out of that system, any species, and there wouldn't be a large impact. Today, because it's smaller, because there's less redundancy, any additional extinction would be expected to have a large impact on the functioning of that ecosystem.
So the things that you concluded and that you're talking about with respect to ancient Egypt, do these reflect realities of other kinds of food webs in other places and other times?
We don't know. We know other food webs certainly have suffered species loss like Egypt has. Egypt is unique in that people have recorded which species were around over millennia. There aren't too many records like that where we have such well-resolved species extinctions that we can reconstruct. There are certainly other examples of systems that have lost a dramatic number of species. For example, one of my favorites is scientists in Seattle were able to reconstruct marine food webs by looking at cookbooks.
Oh my goodness.
So these cookbooks went back into the 1600s and they equated the abundance of different species with the number of recipes found in those cookbooks, with the assumption that the more abundant the species is, the more likely people will be eating it and the more recipes there will be for it. And as you go through time, the number of recipes dwindles for those species that have had dramatic reductions in their abundances. And these species happen to be fish at the top of the food web, which is something that's well known, that we've been losing these larger fish species that potentially form a really important part of the marine food web. And so this is just one of the examples of being able to reconstruct historical systems from data. From human observations, essentially.
Well, I would think, but maybe correct us if that's not right, that the 20th century would be a great example of well-documented species loss.
Yeah, it's an experiment. We're experimenting with the natural world. It's not a good experiment, yeah. I would suggest. But it's important for us to take advantage of what has happened, as horrible as it may be, to try to understand, you know, how these dramatic changes to our ecosystem have impacted how it's functioned, with the hope that we can try to disentangle relationships and rules that we could use to inform how we preserve them in the future. So that's kind of the end goal, is to use, and that's the whole kind of message of historical ecology, is to use past and present perturbations and disturbances to really try to get a handle on how these systems react to these types of big changes. There's even people working on reconstructing the effects of the Permian extinction on food webs 251 million years ago. This is the largest extinction event in Earth's history. How did communities respond to that huge extinction event? How did communities respond to the asteroid that killed the non-avian dinosaurs 66 million years ago? You know, these are big questions, and the only way we can address them is by looking in the past. And hopefully they'll be able to tell us something about how communities of organisms react to these large-scale disturbances, and we can use that information in the future.
I want to just make a little distinction here for our listeners, which is that there's all kinds of disturbances in nature, and some of them, like fire, seem destructive in the short run, but they're actually natural to many landscapes. They keep those landscapes healthy and in balance. And the kind of disturbances you're talking about are things that really throw the whole system off balance. Is that right?
That's right. It's all about time scale, I think. Every ecosystem is under disturbance all the time. Disturbance is a natural part of life. Even large disturbances are natural parts of life. The issue is, when there are large disturbances, and I'm talking about things like mass extinction events, and there's only been five in the history of life on Earth, we're probably in the sixth.
Yeah.
There's a lot of evidence to suggest that we are. And we humans are responsible for a lot of it. We know that from just the last century, or the last couple of centuries. These have profound effects on the community, and we see that by looking in the fossil record, looking at other big extinction events. And these communities serve the basis for everything we use in our lives. We think that we're disconnected from nature, but of course we're not. All of the crops we grow, all of the everything we eat, the air we breathe, we're very connected to the natural world. And life is going to go on. There's no question about that. Communities will always be there of organisms, as long as there's life on Earth. The question is, how will we do as a society in a community that might be very, very different from the one that we're in now? We would like to retain the way that we live. We want to still live on the planet. We want to have civilization. And it's hard to predict what that will look like when the entire community of organisms that we live with has changed. And that's the concern. It's not about life going extinct. It's about being in a totally new environment that we can't predict. And
yeah.
How will we be able to sustain our way of life in that environment? That's a big open question.
We are, as you say, very likely in the sixth mass extinction event. And you named the causes of some of the other mass extinctions in the past, those causes being things like asteroids. What else?
There's a lot of debate in what caused the other ones. Large glaciations, large climatic events caused by various geological activities. But all of these things are very large scale in nature. I mean, they affect the entire planet. The most dramatic of which being asteroid impacts.
Right. But other ones being large parts of the Earth being covered with ice and then not, and then having ice again, and that affects who can live there.
Sure.
Now, what allowed those who survived to do so? In other words, can you tell us what the features are of really resilient species?
Well, there's debate about whether species that survive have certain traits that allowed them to survive. My understanding of this is that most people think that there is no set of traits that lead to survivorship. Survivors are just lucky to be in the right place at the right time. In other words, after the Permian extinction, there were, this is 251 million years ago, and I think 90% of life went extinct, and the survivors took over the Earth. And there were a certain species, I can't remember the name, of reptile-like mammal, or mammal-like reptile, that did really, really well right after that extinction. And all of a sudden, its fossils covered Pangaea, which was the supercontinent, before the continents broke up after the Permian. And as far as people know, there was nothing special about this organism. It just happened to do really, really well afterwards. It happened to survive, and then it flourished because there was all this open space to fill, essentially. So I don't think there is a set of traits that determine survivability from a mass extinction. I think you just have to be lucky.
Well, and that species was lucky, and now it's not there anymore.
Oh, sure. No, it's not there anymore. This was 251 million years ago. So every species comes with an expiration date.
Do we have any species left that are walking around now that were here 250 million years ago?
Well, there's no species that's exactly the same to what it was 251 million years ago. But there were there are certainly species that haven't changed a whole lot, at least morphologically, like jellyfish and, you know, cnidarians, sponges. You know, a lot of these species that we see, particularly in the deep sea, you know, have physiologies and morphologies, their body plan, their shape, that look very similar to fossils that we find.
But these are relatively primitive and water ocean species.
Sure, yeah.
But in terms of creatures crawling around on the earth, crocodiles?
There's a lot of insects that look very similar. Yeah. Crocodiles came around fairly soon, geologically speaking, after the Permian extinction. Mammals were around too, not long thereafter. Mammals and dinosaurs evolved at around the same time. They occupied the same environments. Of course, we look very different now than we did.
We mammals.
We mammals, exactly.
Now, after five mass extinctions, is life getting better at surviving each time?
I don't think it. We're often tempted to label things primitive and derived, successful, unsuccessful. All species that live on the planet today are modern species. There isn't really any primitive species. There are species that have body plans that look pretty similar to what they did, you know, millions of years ago. Those apparently are just very successful body plans, and they work under the environment then, and they work in the environment now. But every animal that's alive today is adapted to the modern world. And so I don't think it's fair to compare the success of organisms today to the success of organisms millions of years ago, because the environments that they lived in were so different. Environments, you know, species millions of years ago were very well adapted to those environments. We would probably find it to be very difficult to survive in those environments. And they would find it very difficult to survive in our environments. So I think over time, every animal evolves in response to its environment. And so I think every era is unique. Every geological era, every animal and group of animals that lived in different time periods is just unique to that time period. So I don't think we've gotten better at surviving. We're just what's here now.
Yeah, yeah. How did you become interested in this work?
In Egypt?
No, in paleoecology, looking at life so long ago.
I just never got over my love of dinosaurs when I was 6 years old. I think it's as simple as that. I've always been fascinated by animals like dinosaurs that are so different than animals that we see today. And I've always just been drawn to communities of organisms that are extinct and strange, and they're mysteries, and trying to understand how they functioned in the world is fun. It's interesting, and it's also informative in the sense that it gives us a better perspective on ourselves and the world that we live in, being able to learn lessons from the dinosaurs. I mean, that's kind of exciting, and it also is building a link between our world and theirs is another part of that. Trying to understand the continuum of life on Earth. We are the tip of the tree of life. We're just around, you know, we're just what's around now. And really life on our planet is understanding that whole tree in its entirety. And most of the life on Earth is extinct.
Yeah. I mean, I was just trying to imagine kind of studying the things that you study and wondering, I mean, for most of us, yeah, we are connected to nature to a greater or lesser extent. We like being outdoors, maybe some people grow their own food or whatever. Mm-hmm. But our lives are so essentially human community centric. Mm-hmm. I mean, our relationships are primarily with one another, and our thoughts and interests and concerns, particularly those of us living in cities, are essentially entirely about human life, human creativity, human activity. Doing the kind of work you do, does it change that kind of perspective? Like, do you see humans as a much lesser part of the whole?
Well, I'm biased because I'm human, and I find humans fascinating as well. You know, we are the universe looking back at itself. You know, we have the ability to recognize where we stand in nature, and that's certainly something that seems to be unique, or at least limited to a few species, perhaps, that we know of. But I do think understanding the continuum of life to increase its richness, to increase the beauty of the natural world. When we look at a tree or a fern or some other species, we can certainly appreciate it by understanding its context in the modern world. It only increases its beauty to understand its context throughout the history of life, knowing how it evolved, where it evolved from, what its ancestors were like, what were primitive forests like, what were the giant insects that existed during the Carboniferous life like. All of the fossils that we burn are a consequence of these huge Carboniferous forests, these giant rainforests, essentially, with huge dragonflies the size of eagles flying around.
Really?
Yeah. Insects that looked like millipedes, 6 feet long. Spider-like scorpions that were the size of a cat.
You know, oh my goodness.
We're more linked to the paleontological world than we think. I mean, when we drive our car, we're burning the remnants of those forests. Yeah, so I think understanding that whole continuum does add a lot of beauty to the world, in my perspective.
We're talking to paleoecologist Justin Yackel. How does the work that you do link to conservation work? In other words, you were sort of implying before that this kind of work has implications for conservation, policy, and the kind of decision-making that we are in pretty urgent need of today.
Yeah. Well, so there's been a big push for, and it sounds like these two words shouldn't go together, but paleontological conservation, paleontology is a study of extinct systems, essentially. For the most part, and conservation has to do with modern systems that are still very much alive and preserving that life. And it really comes back to using the past as a tool to understand the present and the future. Everybody knows the tagline, history repeats itself. It does in the ecological record, in the paleontological record. Are there general responses of communities to disturbances? Is there something general about it? Certainly every ecosystem is unique, every disaster is unique, every mass extinction might be unique, but there might be some consistent ways that communities respond to those big disturbance events. And if there is some consistency, that means there's some underlying generality. And if there's an underlying generality, then there's something, potentially a simple mechanism, that might dictate how those systems respond. And that means that we could use that understanding to inform conservation, how we protect modern systems from further disturbance.
You're talking kind of abstractly. I mean, are there those lessons that we can actually apply yet?
Maybe. This is still an area of really active research. I don't think there's any hard answer yet. From the perspective of Egypt, and again, this is just a single system, so it's hard to say that there's generality there, but we found that there was some basic mechanism that formed the base of whether the system was stable or not, and that was the presence of medium to small to medium-sized herbivores. If that was something that we found in lots of different systems, then we might say, hey, these animals are really important. They're important not just to themselves, but to the system at large. Perhaps we should, put more effort into conserving them. So I'm not saying that is the general rule that we will find, but it's things like that we could use to inform our understanding of other systems. There was a response to our paper in the Proceedings of the Natural Academy of Sciences by a research team in the Levant in Israel, studying the Levant, and they found a similar pattern of extinctions in that area that we found in Egypt. So with regard to systems in that part of the world anyway, there might be a general response of that community to external disturbances. And only by studying other systems, both modern and paleo paleontological, do we have any hope of finding any general underlying patterns that might help us to inform, you know, how we might put our energies into conserving modern systems?
So you've got the study that you guys worked on in Egypt. You've got this one that came from Israel. How many of those do you need that come up, that actually come up with comparable, similar conclusions before you say, okay, this is a pattern, this is what we got to do?
A lot. You need, what you need is systems that are finally resolved, that are from lots of different areas of the world, parts of the world, with lots of different species, and you need to show that the patterns, that there's some generality to the patterns, something similar in all of the systems, even though they're very different in and of themselves. It's more difficult just having Egypt and the Levant. Many of those species are the same. It's a similar part of the world. Egypt and the Levant aren't that far away from each other. So there might be similar climatological effects. There might be similar effects of the population of humans. So those are things that need to be disentangled, and those can only be disentangled by looking at many other systems that have a similar type of temporal resolution that we have in Egypt. I don't know if there's ever a hard line that you cross where you know that you found a general pattern. You can certainly say that you find a pattern that might apply to lots of different systems, or maybe the majority of systems, but there's rarely certainty in this type of science, just because the systems are so complex and unique.
Yeah, I mean, here you are at the Santa Fe Institute, and this is very much part of a, and the methodologies you use are part of this kind of complex systems approach,
right,
to looking at all different kinds of things, not only ecosystems.
Yeah. We hope to find simplicity at the other end of complexity. So, and that's just a fancy way of saying we hope that there's some generality that underlies complex systems, as complex and unique as they are. And that's the challenge. If a system is just complex, then we probably have no hope of understanding it. If a system is complex, but the underlying rules, the underlying processes are simple, that generate complexity, and nature is filled with these types of things, then we have some hope of disentangling it.
But we don't, we're not there yet.
But we don't know yet, yeah. It's possible that every single ecosystem on the planet is completely unique, driven by totally different processes, such that there is no underlying generality that we could, you know, apply some kind of general understanding to aid conservation efforts. Then we face a really difficult situation. I don't think that's the case. Reconstruction of food webs from the Cambrian to the Eocene. This is a lot of work that Jen Dunn has done at Santa Fe Institute to modern systems. They show similarities in their organization. They show deep similarities.
You're talking about food webs maybe in the ocean untold millions of years ago, and then comparing that to ancient Egypt.
Well, so reconstructions of the Cambrian Burgess Shale communities. So these are...
Tell us what that
these
means.
These are... this is a community that existed half a billion years ago in the Panthalassic Ocean.
It was the what?
Panthalassic Ocean. It's an ocean that no longer exists.
Where?
Well, the continents have all completely moved around, so it's a blend of places now. Well, now it's the Canadian Rockies.
Okay.
But so these are invertebrates that are totally different than animals that exist today. They have names like Hallucinogenia and Anomalocaris, you know, just to illustrate how strange they are. Yet the organization of that food web has underlying similarities to the Eocene food web, where we have gigantic mammalian species living in forests. And those are similar to modern lake communities in terms of their structural organization. So here are all these different systems with species that have no relationship with one another, that have totally different morphologies, that are in totally different places and in different times, yet all have a very similar structural similarity.
And what is that structural similarity?
Well, it's the it's the feeding interactions between it's the distribution of the number of feeding interactions within the system. So in other words, you can think of species being a generalist, where it eats lots of different things, or a specialist, where it just eats one thing.
Right.
So you've got... And the distribution of those generalist specialists, like the numbers of those different types of animals within a food web, is consistent from the Cambrian to the Eocene to modern systems.
By specialist, you mean things like, for example, that ferret that only eats prairie dogs.
And yeah,
so
that
if
would
prairie
be
dogs
yeah.
go extinct, then the ferret goes extinct.
Exactly.
By generalist, you mean coyotes that eat everything.
Exactly, yeah. And we are the ultimate generalists.
And we are the ultimate generalists, yeah. And some creatures are in between, like dog, felines, and so on.
And so that distribution of those different types of species play a really important role in the organization and also the function of that food web. It really determines whether that food web is robust to perturbations or not. As you said, a ferret that only eats prairie dogs, well, if the prairie dogs go extinct, that ferret is in big trouble.
Right. But what if you have a food web made up of all generalists? That doesn't work either?
Food webs aren't composed of all generalists. We can play around with systems like that theoretically and see what the consequences are. And I believe those systems tend to be unstable. And that's probably why we don't see them
yeah.
in nature. But the proportional number of those different types of species is very consistent from one community to another. And that suggests that there's some underlying process that's probably fairly simple in nature that controls the emergence of those different types of species within the food web.
That's very interesting. So every food web needs these specialists, and those specialists might be very vulnerable because they only eat one thing.
Sure.
But the larger system needs them in order to be robust.
Yeah, exactly. So generally what you find is that there's very few species that eat a lot of things, and many more species that have essentially smaller diets. And it's remarkable how consistent that pattern is from one system to another, even as far back as the Cambrian, half a billion years ago,
yeah.
When life on Earth, at least multicellular life on Earth, wasn't that old. That formation of that system has already emerged, and it's still here. So there's some mechanism that
yeah.
is similar across all
some
of those systems.
Guiding principles, some set of rules.
Yeah, some kind of feedback, some kind of physical feedback
yeah.
between the organisms and their environment that results in that type of distribution.
What are you working on next?
Well, we're actually looking to apply some of these principles, some of these mathematical tools that we used in Egypt to try to understand how food webs functioned in the Pleistocene between ice ages and during ice ages with the same, you know, with this, where the underlying question is essentially the same. How do these food webs change as the climate changes, as there are these large perturbations, disturbances to the climate? And potentially we'll try to use similar tools to understand North Atlantic systems, where there have been a tremendous number of extinctions in the historical record as species have been overfished. We've lost essentially the top layer of the food web. The top predators have disappeared from the North Atlantic. So how has that restructured food webs? How has that restructured how the community functions? And how would that impact our own conservation efforts?
Justin Yackel is a paleoecologist. He's a postdoctoral fellow at the Santa Fe Institute, and he is an assistant professor at the University of California at Merced. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.